rather appropriate to what's going on this week in the building. We're going to have an informational meeting from OMAP on their plans for the rest of the biennium. Good morning.
Good morning.
We just kind of, in light of everything else that's happening this week and the fact that we're in special session six now. Well, Senator Courtney called it that, and I think it's appropriate. Mm-hmm. We just thought it might be informative for us to kind of get a feel of all the things you folks are going to attempt to do between now and June 30th. So,
all right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lim Reed, the administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, and with me today is Joan Kapowicz, who is manager of our program and policy section within OMAP. And you have a handout in terms of all of the changes that we have been anticipating beginning with January of this year through the end of the biennium. I'll just kind of start walking through, and as you want to spend some time on any one of those, we can stop as we go through. And Joan, as soon as you ask a question that goes to the depth of what the issue is, Joan is the expert here, and she'll chime in as well in terms of responding to questions.
I'm not sure anybody really wants to be classified as an expert in this stuff. That assumes a depth of knowledge none of us may have. So,
and I'll just mention the things that occurred in January as, in terms of startup. On January 1st, we implemented a system of voluntary co-pays for prescription drugs and ambulatory services, things like office visits, for clients who are in our fee-for-service delivery system. Those co-pays apply to have certain exemptions. They do not apply to children under age 19. They do not apply to pregnant women. They would not apply to persons who were being served in our home and community-based waivered system or our developmental disability waivered system, nor would they apply to family planning services or emergency services.
So, Lynn, how many people are we talking about here?
Do you know that number, Joan? I would say probably maybe 100,000 people.
And that's close enough. I'm just trying, ballpark
right.
Numbers are good for this.
Question?
Yes.
And is there any numbers out yet as to how successful this has been for the first month?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, there is not, and in fact, we don't have a systematic way to collect that data. The way this system works is that automatically the copay amount is deducted from the provider's payment, with no indication of whether or not the provider collected the payment. Now, anecdotally, I have heard in some cases that clients are paying, and there have been very few instances where a client has not been able to pay. And then I've also heard that it depends. It varies from area to area. Depending upon how knowledgeable a client may be about the voluntary nature of the copays in terms of a provider is not allowed to refuse to provide service to someone if the person is unable to make the copay.
Sure. Chair Cruz, Representative Moines Anderson. For about 2 weeks, we did an informal survey with our provider services group so that any provider that called in was asked about their collection on copayments. And it did vary quite a bit, although it was surprisingly high. Most of the providers were reporting that most clients were paying, which was somewhat of a surprise to some. Some reported 100%, 70%. It was actually much better than some had anticipated.
Can you state your name for the record,
I'm sorry.
Please?
My name is Joan Kapowicz. I'm the manager of program and policy.
Thank you. Now that you've done it, you don't have to do it again.
The other action that we implemented on January 1st was a reduction in covered services, and that was to move the line on the prioritized list, and this applied to all of our Oregon Health Plan clients, both fee-for-service and managed care. And we reduced coverage by 8 lines. The types of services that were removed from coverage were things like treatment for acne, some forms of skin rash, hives, tear duct problems, things that were of lesser value in terms of health outcomes and status. Beginning February 1, there was a positive in that we expanded coverage for pregnant women and children under the age of 19 from 170% of the poverty level up to 185% of the poverty level. That was a part of the implementation of the Oregon Health Plan 2, OHP2. Also, as a part of
Representative Monson Anderson.
Thank you. And about how much money was this going to cost general fund?
I don't have that exact number with me. It's a little over $300,000 general fund for this biennium. There's a fairly slow uptake, and there are only about 1,500 people that we expect to pick up in this income band.
And Paula?
How many people did you
say? About 1,500.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead, Representative Monson.
And are these women primarily in the metro area, or is it across the state, or where will the impact be greatest? Who will be receiving reimbursement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, we're expecting that the distribution would just look like our regular distribution, which is pretty much based on population and levels of insurance coverage across the state. And so the metro area, obviously, having the largest population, would be we would see more individuals covered there. But not expecting a different distribution than we've seen in the past.
One would assume, based on the numbers you just gave, that if this went forward into the next biennium, it'd be about $2.5 million, roughly, general fund.
Mr. Chair, that sounds approximate to me.
Well, I just
and we can get you some additional. We can get you precise information for 0305. Also, on February 1, we implemented the first component of the OHP2 as it relates to the 110,000 clients in the OHP standard benefit package. The changes that began on February 1 are in terms of benefits and elimination of coverage for vision exams and eyeglasses, elimination of non-emergency medical transportation, elimination of coverage for most medical equipment, a reduction in dental benefits, and then at the same time for this group of eligibles, OHP2 has mandatory copays for most services in both fee-for-service and in managed care. And these copays are generally higher than the copays that were in the OHP Plus population and the ones that were implemented in January. For example, for prescription drugs, it's $2 for generic drugs, $3 for mental health, HIV, cancer, brand name drugs, $15 for all other brand drugs. Hospitalization, $250 per hospitalization. An office visit, $5 instead of the $3 that the OHP Plus population has. So it's much more like commercial insurance in terms of the nature of the copayments.
The physician copay also is for any referrals, too. It's not just gatekeeper copay. It's for any subspecialist that they go to, correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair, and it also applies. There are copays, although at a lesser amount, for things like lab and X-ray. It's a much broader range of copayments for the OHP standard population.
Okay, Representative Tomac.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lynn, so which people on the Oregon Health Plan would this apply to?
This applies to adults ages 19 through 64 who are eligible for Medicaid services because of the Oregon Health Plan. These are the people that we call new eligibles when we started the Oregon Health Plan back in 1994. There are folks that back at that time we couldn't cover under a traditional Medicaid program. Some of them are parents of children who can be covered under the traditional Medicaid program. Others are singles and couples who don't have children in the household. And there is a real mix in terms of the types of needs and expenditures that we make on behalf of these individuals.
Mr. Chair, if I could just clarify for myself. So, Lynn, this would not cover the people who are traditionally covered by Medicaid.
That's correct.
Correct. Thank you.
Lynn, do you have a plan to, I know this is, whether we're 3 weeks in now, do you have a plan to try to determine at least roughly what the collections on these copays are going to be in the next couple months?
Joan, have we moved forward with anything on that?
Chair Cruz, we have not yet moved forward with the plan. We started with the informal survey and haven't been able to formalize an additional process, which might be a mail-out survey. Some providers' offices have indicated that it would be pretty difficult for them to track how many surveys were being, you know, paid, and it would add an additional step, a burden for them to then report back to us. So we've been sort of negotiating how we might do that with minimal burden on our providers.
Okay, and the reason for the question, committee, that copay structure was incredibly controversial in the waiver application steering committee, and there was a bunch that assumed that the majority of it would just be cost shift and not necessarily collectible, and it'd be kind of nice to know, you know, especially I think the one that's most glaring is the $250 hospital copay, and the ability to collect that I think is somewhat in question, and as well as the others, and it just be as we're going through this and trying to determine what in the new waiver stays and what goes away, it'd be kind of nice to have at least some high-level information as to the success or non-success of the implementation of this.
Mr. Chair, we'll see if there's something that we can do to get at, perhaps not in a rigorous scientific way, but to get some information. I would think in the case of hospitals that hospitals would be willing to provide information to us, and we may be able to look at that in particular.
Okay.
The other piece I would mention about these copays is that for the OHP standard population, the copays are what are called mandatory in that a provider does not have to provide the service if the individual doesn't make the copay. However, that's according to our rules, and the federal government allowed us to put that in place. There are other regulations that govern providers, though. For example, a physician couldn't abandon care just because someone couldn't make a copay. A hospital can't turn someone away in an emergency situation. So we're just saying, though, that from our rules and from the federal government's perspective related to Medicaid, the provider does not have to provide the service if the client doesn't make the copay.
Yeah, but I think you made a good point. I mean, hospitals are required by law to provide the services, and the information I've received from the OMA is it's going to be a very rare doctor who's not going to provide based on the fact that the person doesn't have the $5. So truly, this could be a cost shift that has to be picked up elsewhere. I guess, you know, I understand what we're asking is incredibly difficult to do in any way that is at all scientific here, because the implementation is so new. But I'd also be interested in the other eliminations and impacts in the, you know, and we will accept very, very rough numbers and estimates, but well, as Lynn well knows, this comes into play very well in some other venues here. So,
Mr. Chair, we'll see if there's anything we can do. In the case of the other services that have been eliminated, generally there's about a two-month claim lag, so we won't even be able to tell whether or not there's a reduction in utilization at this point in time.
Okay, thank you.
Another component of implementing OHP2 is that those 110,000 eligibles also, although they were required to make premium payments before for their medical benefits, it's a much more stringent policy under OHP2. Previously, someone would receive a monthly bill, and if they didn't make payment on a monthly basis, it didn't matter until it was time for them to reapply in 6 months. And then their premium payments needed to be up to date in order to be made eligible for another six-month period, unless they met one of the exception criteria. And exceptions were made for people who didn't have any income during the preceding 3 months, who might have been a victim of domestic violence, homeless, but primarily it was the zero income that people qualified for in terms of exemptions to the premiums. Now under OHP2, participants are required to make the premium payments on a monthly basis with basically about a 60-day period in which to make that payment. So there's a grace period in there. If someone has not made the payment, though, within that 60 days, they would lose eligibility at that point in time. Would not be able to come back into the program for six months and would need to bring their premium payment current at that time.
But I would point out that the exception process is rather broad, and you know, if they at least make an effort or try to plan something, it doesn't drop.
Mr. Chair, under OHP2, there is no exception process. I failed to mention that. There is the 60-day grace period, but there are no exceptions in terms of someone not making that payment within that time period. That was done away with the new waivers. Another component that's new related to OHP2 is that the 110,000 people or new people like them coming onto the system, there is now a requirement that someone be uninsured for at least 6 months prior to being determined eligible for the health plan. There is a delay in expansion of the individuals, just like the 110,000 at a higher income level. The originating legislation, House Bill 2519, had envisioned that if money were available in a budget-neutral fashion to the state, we would go to higher levels, income levels. And it had been decided back in the emergency board last spring that the initial expansion would just go to 110% when we started OHP2. And then we'd come back and get permission, looking at how well we were doing in terms of remaining budget neutral before moving to higher income levels. And the November emergency board said that we should delay that initial expansion until July. And it sits there right now is until July.
A prudent move.
Also in February, another good thing that we were able to do was we began the rollout of the Senior Prescription Drug Assistance Program. And this will be phased into various counties over a four-month period. It's a program that's available to seniors who have income below 185% of the poverty level. There must be 65 years of age or older and have less than $2,000 in resources, they're not covered, have not been covered by any public or private insurance in the preceding 6 months. It's anticipated, and of course, many seniors covered by Medicare don't have access, don't have prescription drug coverage, and it's anticipated that perhaps as many as 100,000 seniors would take advantage of this program. What the program does is the senior would make a $50 annual payment, and this will fund the administrative costs of the program. And that would entitle the senior to a prescription drug card that allows the senior to buy drugs from participating pharmacies at Medicaid rates. So it's basically a discount program for the seniors from those pharmacies that are participating. And right now we have about a third of the pharmacies who have signed up, including some chain pharmacies and including our mail order vendor. So with the mail order vendor participating, there is definitely an access available to seniors who choose to take advantage of this.
Representative Dalto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I heard an advertisement on the radio as I was driving in this morning. Or not an advertisement, but a news spot about that. So it's working.
That's great. One of the chains has even requested applications, I believe, in order to have available right there at the pharmacy when seniors come up, which is very nice in terms of outreach for the program in assisting low-income seniors.
Question?
Yeah, Representative Mona Sanderson.
The $50, how is that paid?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, the senior would request an application, through our toll-free number. It'll be the same number that someone would call for an OHP application. We'll send out a simple one-page application. The senior fills it in. If it's determined that the senior is eligible, it's at that point in time that the senior would be billed the $50 once it's been determined that they're eligible. It may be possible if we get enough participation. The only intent of collecting the $50 is to cover the operating expenses of the program. And if enough seniors are participating, we may be able to lower that enrollment fee. Also on February 1, the general assistance program was eliminated. This is a cash assistance program that isn't operated by OMAP. It's operated by the department. But basically, it's a pre-SSI program, a program where individuals who appear to meet the criteria for the federal criteria for disability were able to also obtain some cash assistance as well as medical coverage while they were generally going through the SSI application process. And with the elimination of that program, it doesn't mean that these individuals don't have medical coverage anymore, because we are still required, if a person indicates they have a disability, to look to see if they might be considered presumptively eligible for SSI. And so all of the individuals who were in that program at the end of January were rolled over. They've already gone through that process, and they were rolled over into a program that allows them to have the OHP Plus benefit. And people like them in the future, once they've been determined to be presumptively eligible for SSI, would also have the OHP Plus benefit as they continue with their application to the federal SSI program.
Okay, I guess I'm somewhat confused about this, and several questions. Cost-wise, which is more expensive, Plus or general assistance to the state?
Mr. Chair, in terms of the medical costs for these individuals, the costs will be the same to us whether they were in the general assistance category or whether they were in the OHP Plus category. We had intended under OHP 2 that the general assistance category would have OHP Plus medical benefits. Where the state has saved money in elimination of that program is on the cash assistance, the $300 and some that these individuals received. It is also possible, however, that in the future there won't be as many people participating in that program because they may decide that without that cash benefit, the medical benefit isn't enough to bring them in the door.
Well, but if they're eligible for Plus, why aren't they there already?
Mr. Chair, in order to qualify for one of the OHP Plus benefit packages, you have to meet one of the categorical boxes in terms of eligibility, and one of those groups are SSI eligibles. Well, these are people who haven't yet been determined to be SSI eligible. Their disability determination hasn't gone through that federal process yet, which can take a significant amount of time. And so we're required as a state Medicaid program to look and determine whether or not someone is presumptively eligible for SSI, meaning that it looks like they'll be eligible once they get through all of the requirements in that federal program. And once we've determined that it looks like they'll be eligible, then they'll be entitled to the OHP Plus benefit. And then later, if they complete the SSI eligibility process and are found eligible, then that would show retroactively, of course, that they were eligible for SSI. Same cost to the state, though, in terms of their medical benefits.
Okay. Well, I mean, I understand, kind of, sort of, but it's kind of like. The general assistance category was there because by rule they weren't qualified, and now you're rolling them into that without a rule change. I mean,
Mr. Chair, there have been some rule changes, and this stems from a lawsuit back in the early 90s, I believe, requiring the state to do these presumptive SSI eligibility determinations. And there are rules that support that process in place. So truly the only savings here is on the cash assistance side.
Okay, if it was the early 90s that you had to go to a presumptive eligibility standard, one could assume that people have been in general assistance just for the time frame it takes you to make that determination, and not in the time frame that they until they're eligible for SSI, or how has that worked up till now?
Mr. Chair, although someone could have gone through that presumptive SSI eligibility process, and they did, those in the GA program for the most part were doing that. The rules, at one point in time, the general assistance program had broad eligibility, and it was narrowed many years ago. I'm sorry, I'm not an eligibility expert at all, but the criteria was narrowed to make it look like basically a pre-SSI program, someone would come in, apply for this program. There were about maybe 2,800 people who were in the program on as an average monthly caseload. They get some cash assistance. They would get assistance in applying for SSI, and they would be entitled to medical benefits during this time period. And then there was a very high percentage of those individuals who would ultimately be determined SSI eligible. If at the end of that process they were not determined SSI eligible, prior to February 1, most likely they would have been eligible for the OHP benefit package as a new eligible, and that was the same benefit package that they were getting anyway in Medicaid, so it didn't present a problem. Now with OHP 2, of course, that benefit package is a much reduced benefit package under OHP standards, so it's important to individuals that they continue through this process of presumptive SSI eligibility in order to get the OHP Plus benefit.
Okay.
I hesitate to mention the next bullet, which I don't know much about at all. It was just to acknowledge that there is, I'm not sure if it was eliminated or reduced, funding for Oregon Project Independence. And although that's not a Medicaid program, the fact that money is not available to assist some individuals means that their status may deteriorate, and some of them would come qualify for traditional Medicaid eligibility categories over time. And that's the only reason I mention it there.
Question?
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. It would be nice to see if people who then qualify for other categories in OHP would have been held back or wouldn't have actually been eligible if OPI had stayed in. Is there any way to track that, or would you track that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, I am not very familiar myself with Oregon Project Independence. I would think we would need someone from seniors and people with disabilities cluster to look at that and see what kind of tracking they might do, because it would be through their system that they would pick up on that.
And I think it's a relatively small percent that would be eligible.
Yeah, it's very small dollars in terms of that impact that's been identified for our program. The next item also comes out of the Seniors and People with Disabilities section actions, and that was elimination of coverage for the long-term care survival priority levels 15 through 17. And many of those individuals who lose their long-term care benefit would also lose their medical benefit through us, perhaps as much as a third, I'd say a fourth to a third, those individuals will lose their medical benefit.
And excuse me, Representative. How many people are we talking about there?
This was about, just a moment here, initially that was, about 4,200 clients were in the long-term care system losing their benefit, with the expectation that about about two-thirds of those would lose their OHP Plus benefit, 2,800. Now, this was our estimate prior to making that change, and in the meantime, caseworkers have been going through and reassessing what the care level needs are of individuals, and there's been some shift in terms of individuals who've been reassessed and found to meet some, lower...
14s rather than 15s.
Right. Yeah. And so in that case, they would still maintain their medical benefit as well.
Short term.
Well, true. okay, the next, moving on to, I don't want to skip over the rest of the February actions. February 1, we eliminated the medically needy program, impacting about 8,000 clients. That's been a subject of debate and certainly is being considered before the legislature in terms of whether or not that's a program that the legislature wants to provide some more funding for to bring back.
Have we, as a government, been aggressively marketing the programs that are out there as a stopgap? You know, the pharmaceutical companies have their reduced and free and stuff like that. There's been a series of town halls around the state, and I think there's going to be some more to actually sign people up. Are you guys, or is anybody on the government side involved in promoting that sort of way to stem this issue?
Chair Cruz, yes, we have been actively promoting those programs. The information's available on our website. All of the staff who work on our hotlines that answer questions from clients around the state are giving out the phone numbers and information to make sure that we're linking in those individuals with those programs. In addition, we're working with other programs throughout the state and making sure they have the information so they can then assist clients in signing up for these programs. Many of these programs have their individual eligibility criteria, so it often takes somebody sitting down with the client and going through which medications do you have, which manufacturer. It's a little like doing your taxes. It's taxing to go through the forms.
When the notices were sent out telling people that they were being dropped, I'm assuming that's all that notice was. Has there been a follow-up to the clients about the fact that there are other alternatives, or are you kind of doing it in a broader context? It would seem to me that it probably should have been in the initial letter that we're discontinuing your services, but here are other options, sort of thing. Is have we got to that detail of outreach yet or not?
Mr. Chair, I do not believe that we've done that type of broad-based outreach. It's been more that the workers are very aware in the communities, the caseworkers, and the hotlines in terms of connecting people. One of the things that we learned in that process was that for many of the compassionate care programs offered by pharmaceutical manufacturers, there needed to be some proof that somebody didn't have that prescription drug benefit available to them. And once we discovered that, we set up a process so that we will provide that certificate directly to the client so that they can use that to help access the program as well. Some of this has been pieces that we've learned as we go along.
Yeah, and I know that. We're all plowing new ground we haven't had to do before, but I guess you know, in retrospect, it might have been, you know, a lot of notices went out to a lot of people and a lot of different programs saying you're cut, and that's it. And I guess in retrospect, it would have been nice if there were other alternatives out there that they were given those at the same time they were told they were being cut. And, you know, and just kind of if we ever get in the situation again, that might be useful to know.
Thank you. The last thing under February that I'll mention is the elimination of the last of the money that had been in a special reserve for safety net clinics. The 2001 legislative session had set up a little over $2 million reserve to be distributed to safety net clinics through the special sessions and rebalance and then House Bill 5100. Ultimately, in three different actions, the last of that money went to meet the shortfalls that the state was experiencing rather than going to the safety net clinics. In March, March 1st, this coming Saturday, there are further reductions to the OHP standard benefit package. For that 110,000 eligibles, the remainder of their dental benefit will be eliminated. They will lose coverage for medical supplies, things like diabetic test strips, the full range of services, medical supplies. Oxygen, coverage of outpatient mental health services, coverage of outpatient chemical dependency services, and coverage of prescription drugs.
Who came up with this list, and what process did they go through to arrive at what should or should not be cut? Clearly, I think part of this list puts us in legal jeopardy, and that would be the mental health services. So who developed this list?
Well, Mr. Chair, this is the list, the prioritized list of benefit packages developed by the Health Services Commission.
Okay.
It's in priority order, and listed in priority order here, except that mental health and chemical dependency were one benefit package in terms of the work they did. What this does is it leaves, that uses up all the flexibility that we received with the OHP2 waivers to reduce benefits. It leaves the 110,000 eligibles with what are called basically mandatory Medicaid services, physician, lab, X-ray, hospital, ambulance, still with that overlay of the prioritized list overlays that, and co-pays overlay that, and then there are still premium requirements for those individuals.
Okay. Part of the reason I brought this up is that the shift from a peer prioritized list to this benefit package model was another hotly debated issue in the Waiver Steering Committee, and I'll let it go at that. Just to say that there was not general consensus on whether that was the appropriate way to go, although there was a majority who supported it, but I think it was 11-10 vote.
Mr. Chair, I will also say that the Health Services Commission has written a letter indicating that they would be more than happy to step up to the plate and to help work through looking at redesign of a benefit package targeted at this population. That the work they engaged in initially had never envisioned that it was really going to this level. They believe that that they have a lot of public input that they've gathered, and their next meeting they've scheduled to be here in Salem to be available also for folks.
Well, part of the problem was that this way of ordering things was not what 2519 requested of them. What 2519 requested of them is what they're now offering. So, and that's to take a look at the prioritized list and see if there's adjustments can be made there. So, I just bring this up because I lived this last summer. But go ahead.
All right. The next bullet is that on March 1, we're going to change how we handle, for the 110,000 eligibles, the OHP standard population for those who are newly coming onto the program. In the future, when they submit their applications, their beginning date of eligibility will be the first of the month following the determination that they're eligible. The way it works today, when a person requests an application, that establishes a date, a beginning date of eligibility, assuming they're found eligible in the next month and a half or so. And so that's been used a lot by hospitals, by safety net clinics, by chemical dependency providers as a way to, when somebody is presenting for care, to establish a date of eligibility by getting an application date stamped, thus entitling the provider eventually to payment from the Medicaid program, assuming the individual was found eligible. So this will be a future date of eligibility for these clients from here on out.
So to a degree, this is another cost shift. I mean, and the reason I say that, Lynn, is because if somebody presents, they've got a medical reason for presenting, and if they present on the 5th of March and they get the services and basically get through whatever it is, and they're not eligible until the first, I mean, we don't pick them up till the 1st of April. Basically, the provider is picking up that book of business, and we are not financially liable for it.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Mona Sanders.
Will this hurt some clinics or providers more than others? And I guess I'm thinking of the safety net clinics in particular. Would think this type of thing would actually hurt them more than others because it's usually those who go to the safety net clinic that don't have the insurance.
Right.
And I'm thinking of a pregnant woman, isn't going to be on insurance and then presents themselves. And usually the whole cost at the initial pregnancy exam is that they'll just have to delay that complete exam if they want to be financially astute, but otherwise it will be a cost share.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, actually for a woman who is pregnant, she is not would not be in the OHP standard group. She would be over in the OHP plus group, would still have that retroactive date of eligibility. So it wouldn't apply to the pregnant woman. But I think it will disproportionately apply to safety net clinics who do outreach, who are serving low-income individuals. Although the biggest impact is on hospitals in terms of this change.
Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate what you said about there being a cost shift in this kind of care. But I think in all fairness, there may be another element, too. I just covered an employee, and there was about a month and a half period of time before she would actually get services. And I think what it did psychologically, it said, I have no coverage until a month and a half from now. I really can't go in. So that maybe except in emergency services, people do tend to hang off until that coverage actually does take over. Is that an element?
Yeah, and you're probably right as far as folks presenting at a physician's office, and maybe to a degree a clinic, but emergency services happen when they happen.
Yes.
So
that you can't avoid.
Yeah. But that is a good point, and a lot of this has to do with behavior change, and until we maybe have a setup like this so that we get at least some of the population, probably not very many at the very beginning will learn this, but that insurance is important and that it will sort of force them to be on the plan even when they don't need it. I mean, this, and that's what we have to work on, sort of a behavior change. It'll be interesting to see if it works.
Indeed. The next bullet starts to get into some of the provider reimbursement changes. And this one would reduce payments to pharmacies from average wholesale price minus 14%, which we pay today, to average wholesale price minus 17%. Now, this is something that does require approval through the state plan amendment process with the federal government. And we have a state plan amendment up there. It has not been approved yet, and today's pretty much our drop-dead date in terms of being getting that approval and implementing this on March 1st. So we will not be implementing this reduction on March 1st, although that begins to build a hole in our budget to be addressed.
Why 17? I can understand adjustments wanting to be made, but we're looking at going to 17, and we're looking at, Rite Aid said potentially they're going to say goodbye, and I would assume some of the other chains would follow, and clearly the mom and pops, it becomes unaffordable for them at that point. So why 17? Why not 15? Just dollars?
Mr. Chair, the reason we had settled on minus 17, well, once again, we were dealing with having to come up with reductions and what is the array of reductions that would accomplish the, in our case, $40 million in general fund cuts, which is about a 20% reduction overall in program. And minus 17 was chosen in this particular reduction because of an Office of Inspector General report, which had indicated looking at a number of states, although Oregon wasn't one of them, on a national basis, what is the acquisition cost, average acquisition cost for drugs in pharmacies serving them, serving our populations. And AWP minus 17, it was minus 17 point something, was the average acquisition cost for the single source innovator brand drugs, the discounts ranged on up to over 70% when you got into some of the generic drugs. So ours is AWP minus 17% applied to all drugs who aren't picked up in our Oregon maximum allowable cost pricing or the federal upper limit pricing. Pharmacies, certainly are indicating that this is a problem for them, and access certainly is an issue, and that's one of the things that CMS is looking at as well. But it was because of that OIG report that we chose the 17.
Okay, I guess my concern is if the chains drop out and the drugs are no longer accessible, we have shifted a hell of a lot of cost to other parts of the system.
Mr. Chair, certainly that's a real concern in terms of people not accessing necessary drugs. At the same time, we have put in place, we've executed a new contract for a mail order pharmacy. The mail order pharmacy vendor will charge us AWP minus 21% for brand name drugs and AWP minus 60% for generic drugs. The mail order vendor believes that they can still operate at those discount rates, and that is available then to our clients, but it doesn't meet, the acute needs for clients, but can be a good source for maintenance drugs, and almost 75% of our prescription drugs are maintenance drugs.
Representative.
Thank you. You can't mail some scheduled two drugs and so on. Is that not correct? So.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I believe that is correct. Joan can confirm that. And so it doesn't work for all drugs.
What are these?
Schedule 2?
Controlled substances, narcotics.
They're the biggies. They're the ones that have street value and things like that. That's true.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give me those figures again? 16 for... or 21%?
Mail order is AWP minus 21% for brand name drugs and AWP minus 60% for generic drugs. 60.
Okay.
Dispensing fee of $3.50.
And you're assuming at this point, today's a drop dead date, that you're not going to you're going to get permission to move forward at this point.
Right. And since sometimes you can move forward after you submitted a state plan amendment without approval, taking a chance that it will be approved and that you'll be able to claim federal match once it's approved, retroactive back to when you implemented the change. But this is one that, there's enough back and forth discussion on the issue that we're not prepared to move forward and implement it without that federal okay. But as I said, it continues to build a hole for us because the budget assumes that we have implemented this on March 1. The next item is also a reimbursement change, and that is related to DRG, what we call DRG hospitals, diagnosis-related group hospitals, which are basically hospitals of 50 beds or more. The DRG is just a payment methodology. And for those hospitals, we will reduce inpatient and outpatient reimbursement by 12% on March 1. And we will also eliminate what are called outlier payments except to hospitals that serve a disproportionate share of low-income individuals for infants under age 1. And outlier payments are for those exceptional cost hospitalizations, like a neonate, maybe a burn victim, someone who has a very, very high cost stay compared to the normal cost of a stay for that particular diagnosis.
Yeah, Representative Warren Sanderson.
I don't remember what a DRG hospital is. Are they for those hospitals that are in our rural areas, are they usually less than 50 beds?
They generally are, and in fact that would be the next reduction item, which are hospitals of less than 50 beds. They're type A, what are called type A and type B hospitals. The type A hospital, less than 50 beds and more than 30 miles from another hospital, so truly a rural or distant hospital. And type B are less than 50 beds, but another hospital is within 30 miles of that hospital. For example, Silverton Hospital or Santa Yam Hospital. Those are type B hospitals because they're small, but it's less than 30 miles to another hospital. And currently those hospitals, type A and type B hospitals, receive cost-based reimbursement under the Medicaid program, and that's required in Oregon by statute. And this is listed as a change effective March 1st, but it required that statutory change before we can implement this. The bill has not moved forward, and so at this point in time, we're not going to implement this change in reimbursement on March 1st. So once again, that's another item that will add to the budget problem that we will face as we have our upcoming rebalance.
When did you go through the rule process on reducing reimbursements for DRGs?
We had Chair Cruz. We had a hearing last Friday for that change. Do you want to know the date we filed the rule, or that was when the hearing was? January 15th was when the rule was filed, and February 21st was when the hearing was held.
Okay. Was that a lot of fun?
Chair Cruz, I wasn't at the hearing. I didn't hear the word fun used in conjunction with it. We did receive a number of comments.
Okay. I often wonder in rulemaking. I've always had a problem with the process behind rulemaking because they tend to be set up more to meet with the schedule and needs of the agencies rather than the people being affected. But I often, it seems like it's very rare that we have the people being affected being able to change the mind of the agency to go forward with what they're doing. And one would assume in this case anybody that came in to talk about that from the hospitals. We're probably saying this is not a good deal, but we're going to go ahead and do it anyway. Would that be relatively correct?
Well, Mr. Chair, in this case, no, because we're not going to do it until such time as a statutory change would take place.
For the DRG.
For the DRG hospital, yes, we are moving forward with that. We have received the comments. I've read the comments. We are moving forward. Unfortunately, we have to effect a 20% reduction in program in the last 4 to 5 months of the biennium in order to be within budget. About 98% of our budget goes out to provider payments, and so that means reductions in eligible benefits or provider reimbursement, and this is a mixture of all three in terms of what we've come up with within the constraints we had to operate.
And I will agree that there are some statutory constraints that are somewhat limiting at this point in time, and we hope to be addressing those. But I'd also point out the fact that provider reimbursements have been pretty much a fixed figure for a longer period of time than things like, we keep expanding eligibility over time, and it seems like when we add new dollars, that's been about the only place that they've gone is expansion. And it is a three-legged stool. And based on the report from Price Waterhouse, we're way behind on reimbursements at this point in time. And so here we are cutting them again. I'm a little uneasy about that. So.
Next item at the bottom.
Representative Anderson, just a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm to assume from dropping the reimbursements at the DRGs and eliminating them that we're essentially forcing all the patients in Eastern Oregon into St. Charles and all of the patients in Southern Oregon to Rogue Valley Medical Center to the major hospitals?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't think so, because it's the next to the last bullet that impacts the smaller hospitals, the type A and type B hospitals. And although this proposed eliminating the cost-based reimbursement, were there to be a statutory change, which, of course, you will decide as legislators on whether or not you would change the statute, those hospitals would be paid at the DRG methodology. And so there would still be payments made. The question, of course, would be the very reason the legislature has decided in the past to protect these hospitals with cost-based reimbursement is that enough to make the hospitals viable? But at this point, I don't see any change happening.
Probably not. The bill's in this committee and hasn't been scheduled yet. So, and I just don't know if we're going to find time.
I better speak faster then. The last bullet on this page is...
that was good, Lynn.
The last bullet on this page is an expansion of prior authorization requirements for prescription drugs in our fee-for-service system. We believe that there are a number of things that we can do that would still focus on patients getting the prescription drugs they need, but targeting them more to prescription drugs that have the lesser cost that will still meet the need. And we're underway right now working through what some of those changes would be.
Okay, this is based on Senate Bill 819.
Mr. Chair, one of the areas in which we would look would be related to Senate Bill 819, which is our preferred drug list, practitioner-managed prescription drug program, is that what we've seen in that program with a very liberal exception process that's driven by the prescriber is there is about, for those drugs that have been evaluated in that process, about a 25% switch rate to the preferred drug. States that have more aggressive preferred drug lists that are supported by prior authorization see more like a 90% switch rate. So there is an opportunity there. There are some drugs where it would make sense to try what's called step therapy. You try one drug, which generally will work for individuals as a first step in the therapy, and then you graduate to other more expensive drugs as the medical need indicates. There are some drugs that are used to a significant degree for treatment of services that are not covered under the Oregon Health Plan, for below-the-line services, and we'd look to putting some of those, more of those drugs on the prior authorization list so that it could be evaluated to see whether or not this is a drug that is being used for a covered condition.
I guess I'm wondering, where is the authority to go to prior authorization for fee-for-service? I mean, was that out of 819?
Mr. Chair, it's not actually a direct component out of 819. We have authority in statute to prior authorize for medical necessity and to prior authorize for covered conditions. And so we would be looking at these from a clinical perspective. And so those drugs that would be identified would be within that clinical context of medical necessity, or would be addressing whether or not it's a covered condition. And maybe one of the ways, one of the actions that are on here that have the lesser impact on individuals and compared to some of the things we're doing, like eliminating prescription drugs for a fourth of our eligibles. In April, on page 3, this is seniors and people with disabilities action item to eliminate long-term care coverage for persons in survival priority levels 10 through 14. And as with the earlier reduction for levels 15 through 17, losing the long-term care coverage means that approximately a third of those individuals would also lose their about two-thirds of those individuals would lose their medical coverage. And it's about, at the time this was put together, it was identified about 4,800 clients in the long-term care levels.
Okay, now the Ways and Means folks are working with the agency on trying to do some adjustments to prevent that from happening, as I understand. How is that going, or do you know?
Mr. Chair, I do not know how it's going in terms of making progress. I do know budget staff have been working with Legislative Fiscal Office in terms of pricing various options, and I know that legislators are looking hard for something that would ameliorate the impacts.
Okay, of course, the way to do it was identified in 5075, but we don't know what the ultimate result of that's going to be at this point.
The next item here actually won't happen. We had originally identified eliminating payment of the Part B Medicare premium for persons whose income is above 120% of the federal poverty level. This is a program where the federal government was paying 100% match. So it didn't cost the state anything to make these premiums for people between 120 and 135% of the poverty level. But the federal government was going to eliminate their funding. We wouldn't be able to claim Medicaid match for continuing to do it in-state. So we were going to drop that program. But the funding bill that just passed recently in Congress has extended their payments for this program until October. And the president's proposed budget would continue this program. So this is a good one that we will not have to move forward with. In May, and this has been delayed a month, to June, Pharmacy Benefits Manager, First Health, is putting in place an upgrade to their system that will allow us to require basically a kind of an instantaneous billing. When pharmacies go to submit a claim for one of our Medicaid clients, there will be a look to say, is this a Medicaid client who has a third-party carrier that covers insurance for the individual, and allow for that billing to occur and basically divert off to the third-party insurance carrier instead of to Medicaid. And what we've done with those in the past is that we have in the past paid those pharmacy claims because we didn't didn't have the ability to do this electronically. And then we've gone in, retroactively identified all those clients who had third-party coverage for prescription drugs and billed the insurance carriers. A pay and chase is basically what it was called. And so what we're going to do with this new system is avoid making that payment up front and have the pharmacy go direct to the insurance carrier.
How many, what percent of your population would this affect?
Do you have
I mean, it's got to be relatively small.
I would think, Cruz, it is a small percent. I only know the estimate of what we thought we would save per month. It's $400,000 general fund a month.
Per month?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Well, when you say save, but in the pay and chase, you're still collecting.
This is true.
It's you just get the use of the money sooner this way.
Well, which was important this biennium.
I understand that. But I don't want the assumption that they haven't been collected. It's just whose account they're sitting in for a month or two is the issue.
The other piece, Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct, though, is that whenever you go in a pay-and-chase environment, you're not always successful in collecting that information. In a cost-avoidance environment, you'll have a better return than you would in the pay-and-chase environment. And then just the last point I would make here in that last section was that the governor's balanced budget continues all of these reductions on into 2003-05. In addition to that, it eliminates the adult dental benefit for the OHP plus population. And that budget assumes that there is no increase in utilization of services, the severity and mix of services, or price inflation. Now, obviously, you can't contain those things to a zero gain, and so that's part of what's being worked on by the various committees, because this picture isn't sustainable in terms of maintaining the program, and that's looking to the future and what the Oregon Health Plan should look like in 2003-05.
I found it very interesting that the governor's budget would choose to ignore the Pricewaterhouse report. I mean, that's a significant, utilization is certainly something that has to be looked at, as does reimbursements. And, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing that I think is major that has been left off this technical balanced budget, I think Representative Modis Anderson and I would agree that, and probably all of us would agree, that prevention is a major thing that we're really not taking advantage of. We're paying bills, we're accepting increases in eligibility and costs, but we're not talking to the American or to the Oregonians about how you can help yourself, and putting some weight behind that by telling them we're going to be weaning you off some of the services that you've been used to. You've got to take care of your own body. You've got to start helping yourself and not throwing it all over to government. So I hope you can communicate to the governor's office that prevention is going to have to be necessary for the whole American people, not just for Oregon.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. And if you're interested in some of the prevention activities that we've engaged in, particularly through managed care, Joan and her staff have been very engaged in that effort.
Great.
I'm assuming that one of them will be smoking cessation.
Not aimed at anyone in particular. Mr. Chair, Representative Comey, indeed, that has been one of the areas that we focused a lot of attention on in the Medicaid program in terms of smoking cessation. And as has all of Oregon, but also in our Medicaid population, if you look at the number of pregnant women who smoke, we've seen some very good results over the course of the Oregon Health Plan as a result of those efforts and broader efforts in the state.
Thank you, Lynn.
You know, this is my third session chairing this committee, and never before has my committee been so concerned over my health.
They haven't loved you as much as we have.
Oh, there you go. Any other questions on this really good news we're getting? Well, I appreciate this. This is, you know, like, you know, we've been working on this, and we start again tonight.
Yes.
In our work group, but it's, I think it's important for us to, as a committee, to know the lay of the land here as we move forward. Are you doing any testifying today in Ways and Means, or?
Mr. Chair, I believe the department may be, but it's not OMAP yet.
You've been spared at least for today.
Right. We're waiting for you to find the solutions.
Lynn, we're going to find them together, I believe, aren't we? Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Anything else for this panel? Thank you very much. Is there anybody out there that would like to kind of comment on this stuff, or do we want to let it go for now? Uh-oh, I can open it up. Now we're going to get Ruby. Good morning, Ruby. Did you have a nice weekend?
Mr. Chair, I struggled through the weekend, as I'm sure many of the members of your committee did.
Yes, yes. Please, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ruby Houghton. I'm the Legislative and Public Affairs Director for CARE Oregon. CARE Oregon is a small nonprofit business operating in 16 counties in Portland, headquartered in Portland, and providing services to about 100,000 individuals on the Oregon Health Plan. We are OMAP's largest Oregon Health Plan contractor.
You have 100,000 clients and you call yourself small.
We have about 100 employees who take care of those clients as well. That's kind of small. As a result of the cuts to the Oregon Health Plan population, CARE Oregon has had to take a number of actions that I thought that I would share with you. On February the 21st, we notified OMAP that we would no longer be able to serve the Oregon Health Plan standard population. That's about 25,000 CARE Oregon clients. Our board wrestled with this, had great difficulty, as did staff and management. Our commitment was to serve low-income, vulnerable Oregonians, and this was devastating for us as an organization to say that we would no longer be able to serve them, particularly with DME, mental health, and chemical dependency gone, and March 1 prescription drugs. This is a population that our providers said to us they were going to have great difficulty serving without prescription drugs, and we were not going to be compensated in a way that would allow us to be able to serve the Oregon Health Plan standard population. So in effect, continuing to serve this population could have taken us as an organization completely under. The changes that we have made since notifying OMAP is that we notified our 25,000 patients that we would no longer be able to serve them and that they would be going to fee-for-service. We also provided them information on the compassionate drug programs, in addition to offering them services through our customer service line to assist them in finding a provider that would take fee-for-service, as well as getting signed up for drug benefits through the compassion programs. We notified our staff. As of last Thursday, we had to lay off 22 staff people, and these are tough times for us as well. We also on and Friday and today will be sending out letters to legislators, making them aware of the actions that we have had to take and why. I wanted to make sure that I came before this body this morning to let you know that this was not an easy decision for CARE Oregon. It was painful, but it was financially necessary, very similar to many of the things that you were having to do here. And we wanted to pledge our support to continue to work with you to make sure that we actually are able to hold together the infrastructure that has been put in place to assist low-income, medically vulnerable Oregonians.
Questions?
Yeah, Representative Moyne Sanderson.
Thank you for the news. How many clients will Carrigan then have if they lose the 25,000?
We'll have about 70, 75,000 clients.
70 to 75,000.
Yes. And those will be all Oregon Health Plan Plus representative.
Representative Barker.
I don't know if you could answer this. I'm going to throw out you. Everybody, and we've talked today, the other group too, about the compassionate care program the pharmaceutical companies have. How long is that? How long will they be able to do that, or how long will they do that? I mean, I don't see that. I mean, I'm guessing that they're not going to say, we'll just do this forever.
I mean, Mr. Chair, Representative Barker.
Oh, he's left the room.
Mm-hmm.
the pharma representative was in the room, but this, their compassionate program is not set up to do the kind of work that we are asking them to do. And we know that it will run out, but it's about the only tool that we have in place right now.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Thank you very much.
To a degree, it was set up to kind of bridge the gap while the feds messed around with the drug benefit and Medicare, I think, probably as much as anything else. But Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tell me again how many employees you had to cut, Ruby?
22.
22.
Out of how many?
Out of about 130.
Ruby, if you're down, if we are down to categoricals, can you survive? Long term.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we continue to do analysis, and as many of you know, Care Oregon is financially strapped as it is. We took on the Metropolitan Solution, which our previous governor asked us to pretty much double in size about 2 years ago. And as a result of that, we expanded far beyond our capacity at the time. And so we are financially strapped, and there is a possibility that we may not make it.
I mean, and you,
we intend to make it.
I know. You expanded into some regions that on your own you probably wouldn't necessarily have gone.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the Metropolitan Solution was the exit of Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield and Providence from the greater Portland area. And so what we did was we expanded into the private physician market in a time when we had, for the most part, focused on the safety net providers in the greater Portland area. And the cost of caring for those patients in the greater Portland area was much more than we were accustomed to.
Okay, I guess one of the things I'm wondering about is if we're down to categoricals, which is a very real possibility at this point in time. Is,
Mr. Chair, will you explain categoricals?
Okay, what I mean is those people, categoricals are the people we have to cover to have a Medicaid program in the state. There's a bunch of categories, pregnant women, children, TANF, about six or eight different groups of folks in there. Okay? Mm-hmm. Okay. Is that an adversely selected enough clientele that makes it problematic for you? I mean,
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, within the categoricals, there are populations that are easier to care for, and then there are populations that are more difficult. Care Oregon, in particular, has a large percentage of the population of folks who are disabled. In our Oregon Health Plan standard population, we have a lot of the transplant patients. We had a lot of the AIDS and HIV patients. Given the fact that we're in the greater Portland area and one of our partners in hospitals is OHSU as well as the OHSU clinics, and we also have a large percentage of people with diabetes. So the populations that appear to be most vulnerable tend to gravitate towards Care Oregon. So I think that there will be some adverse selection relative to this population. And for the short term, the people who are off Oregon Health Plan, who will be off Care Oregon and in the fee-for-service market, will be there, I believe, for a short amount of time, and that many of those people will become disabled and they will be back to us. So, yes, adverse selection will occur in that way.
Yeah. Thank you. The frustration out of all of this is we're just cost-shifting all over the place. When we had Kaiser, Providence, Regent, all helping with the cost of these patients, then everyone could survive. But they are expensive, and especially in recession times, they're not going to get served. And it's very frustrating, because it would be nice in the real world that we weren't in a recession and everyone wanted to take care of this population.
That's true.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Ruby, so people who have transplants, who once they're out of Care Oregon, they're not eligible to get the drugs that would keep their transplants viable. So then would they become part of the eligibles, part of the plus organ or Medicare? No.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, once a person, and we've got the specialist sitting here, but, and correct me if I'm wrong, Joan, once a person is off of their transplant drugs for a time, they should not go off of them.
Right.
Once they're off of those drugs for a period of time, and I got this directly from our medical director, they will become severely disabled. They may die.
Eligible for Medicaid.
Then they would be eligible again for OHP Plus.
Yeah, right. That's what I was getting at.
Right?
Thank you.
Okay.
Right. Thank you.
There's no way to avoid having to categorize people. I mean, there's no other way to do a system.
Yeah. And they, Representative Cruz, Chair Cruz, and Representative Tomei, and they will also run up hospital costs in the fee-for-service environment, these people who are particularly medically vulnerable. So HIV-AIDS patients who don't have their meds, transplant patients, people with type 1 diabetes, people with heart problems, et cetera.
Any other questions of Ruby?
Mm-hmm. Not of Ruby, but does Reed.
Okay. Thanks, Ruby.
Just a quick question. Care Oregon is cutting 22 people out of their 130. What kind of cuts has DHS made?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, DHS has cut over 400 positions. And is holding, during a hiring freeze, I think something over 500 positions, maybe approaching 600 positions now.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Just for the committee benefit and the audience, I just want to note that Friday we're having Drug Day here in committee, which is a good way to enter a weekend, I think. But and we're going to have the pharmaceutical manufacturers come in and talk about their programs and what they can do to assist in trying to deal with these issues. Plus, we're going to hear from things from the generic side also. So it should be a good informative day and give you maybe more information than you currently have as to what we can do to help folks, and that information will also be available at that point in both the caucus offices. I've already talked to Representatives Kafori and Knope about their willingness to have that information available for members, and they're both more than happy to do it. So that will kind of be distribution points. I don't know what those on the fourth floor are going to do. I guess I'll have to come downstairs. Anyway, that's just to let you know that we aren't quite walking away from all this stuff quite yet. So Representative Anderson.
Just one final note. I passed out to you some comments from a local constituent of mine that actually he's in Corvallis, I believe, but he's a friend of a very close friend. Just thought it might be helpful in the overview.
Okay. There are no other questions. Thank you very much. This was very informative. Thank you, Lynn. See you tonight. And we are adjourned. Thank you.